Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from May 19, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Chavalata Sutta, a sutta on right intention and dana. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace. So the Chavalata Sutta. In this sutta, right intention, dana, and dhamma practice, the Buddha teaches that right intention and the paramita of dana are fundamental aspects of the highest form of dhamma practice. Right intention grounded in right view is the action arising from the perfected mind state of dana. Just a little background on that. Dana means generosity, and the opposite of generosity would be stinginess or clinging, which is the problem. So an awakened mind is a mind that is free of all of that clinging and is always generous. And as you'll see in the sutta, the most important thing that we can be generous with is our understanding of the Dhamma. And that's what I say right here. In the Chavalata Sutta, the Buddha teaches that there are four types of individuals in the world. Those that do not seek to develop understanding of the Dhamma, those that develop understanding of the Dhamma for others, but not for their own benefit, and that's very akin to the many of the applications of the so-called Bodhisattva path. Those that develop understanding of the Dhamma for their own benefit, but not for others, and those that practice for their own benefit and for the benefit of others. The Buddha teaches the individual who practices neither for their own benefit nor for that of others is unrefined. The individual who practices for the benefit of others but not for their own benefit is the higher and more refined of those two. The individual who practices for their own benefit but not for the benefit of others is the highest and most refined of these first three. The individual who practices for their own benefit and for the benefit of others is of these four the foremost, the most outstanding, the highest, and the supreme. With no engagement in the Dhamma, one will remain unrefined. Engaging in the Dhamma with the intention of benefiting others, but with no intention of benefiting oneself, is more refined than an individual with no Dhamma practice, but it is still arising from a clinging view of self. This is an extreme view as it disregards the necessity to develop an individual understanding of the nature of clinging, aversion, and deluded thinking. It's kind of a long-winded say of you're now creating an identity of being a Buddhist practitioner without really developing the Dhamma in any realistic way. This view is a very subtle way of avoiding applying the Dhamma to individual conditioned mind. Those whose intention is to develop understanding for their own liberation will develop a more refined understanding of the Dhamma as the previous two. This is a more refined understanding as it requires the right intention to abandon clinging. This type of Dhamma practice is grounded in right view and a basic understanding of the Four Noble Truths. This is the typical entry point into the Dhamma for most individuals. In other words, that's usually our intention when we begin, and hopefully as we develop the Dhamma, we'll generate the more refined intention of that fourth type of individual. As long as the practice of developing understanding within the framework of the Eightfold Path is maintained wholeheartedly, the perfected quality of mind of Dhana will naturally develop, leading to the development of the fourth type of individual. Right intention follows initial right view. Understanding the origination of dukkha brings the intention to abandon clinging. Dhana, generosity, is a mind state that develops as clinging is diminished. As individual Dhamma practice continues through right effort, all forms of clinging are abandoned. That's why I stated earlier and why the Buddha states that Dhana, the perfected mind state of Dhana, is the ongoing mind state of an awakened, fully mature human being. Those whose intention is to develop their understanding of the Dhamma for their own benefit and for all others have found a true middle way. This is a highly refined practice that arises from an understanding of the extreme view of aversion to all understanding and the ascetic-like view of holding only an outwardly focused, altruistic engagement with the world. So that last definition does somewhat bring to mind the Bodhisattva vow, But the difference is really in that intention. And so the Buddha understood that before he could be any truly worthwhile or have any real benefit as a teacher, he would first have to awaken himself. And when you think about that, that's just common sense, doesn't it? You really can't teach something unless you've had the experience of it. He always referred to himself prior to his awakening as an unawakened bodhisattva, which means that he was imbued in a living example of great compassion, but he was lacking that final understanding of the true nature of life, the true nature of the Four Noble Truths. And that's why he taught that in his first teaching, and then everything he taught after that was in that context of the Four Noble Truths. This middle way of seeking awakening or arahantship for oneself, with the intention that you will gain the ability to also benefit others, brings the true meaning of dana, great generosity of spirit, to an individual practice. So you often hear me say the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all other sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. In that way, for one thing, I know that I will no longer be contributing to the disappointment and unsatisfactory nature of the world, to the suffering of the world. But also, as I develop the Dhamma, I will be developing the wisdom along the way to know how to apply the great paramitas of generosity and loving kindness and great compassion and concentration, rather than putting the cart before the horse and making my practice a practice of compassion but lacking the true understanding of the Four Noble Truths, which is a very subtle way that many people practice Buddhism today, and it leads to some of the more extreme examples of so-called engaged Buddhism. That's not to say that all engaged Buddhism is hurtful, but a lot of it is because it's lacking wisdom. It's really taking a view of what the world should be and attempting to impose that on others. And that contradicts the First Noble Truth, that dukkha occurs. It's simply a consequence of living in the world. It's a compassionate view that's lacking true wisdom. With the realization that through understanding your own clinging, aversion, and confusion, you can effectively help others is the path of an awakened human being. The Buddha's own life exemplifies the ideal of the arahant as the highest and supreme individual in the world. As the Buddha became aware of the nature of suffering, he sought understanding of suffering and its origination. Upon his awakening, he presented the four Noble Truths so that all human beings can understand and abandon the origination of dukkha. Another great example of this: when the Buddha realized at the age of 29 the inherent suffering in the world, when he talked about that, he said birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, not getting what is desired is suffering, getting what is undesired is suffering, and then he would conclude that by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. The five clinging aggregates are the personal experience of suffering. At the age of 29, he still could have taken the compassionate view but lacking wisdom and realized that the power he had as the son in his father's kingdom, he was in a great example of addressing some of the needs of suffering in the world, wasn't he? And he could have used that power in certain altruistic ways. But he understood that it wasn't just in helping other people. And it wasn't just in attempting to ease other people's suffering. What he understood, at least initially, and he hadn't developed it yet, was the ongoing problem of suffering was something that he wanted to understand, and if there was a way to alleviate it completely, again, not just help other people through it, but to teach them how to end their own contribution to suffering, that is what motivated him. That's why he left the kingdom and went seeking that understanding. And again, it was that motivation. You can really see the bodhisattva mentality that was driving him to leave the kingdom and seek understanding. And he understood that. He was imbued with that great compassion of a bodhisattva, but lacking the understanding of the nature of suffering. Not all Dhamma practitioners will formally teach the Dhamma. Many will express the highest form of understanding by encouraging others towards the Dhamma. Still others will express their understanding through the example of their lives and through a great generosity of spirit. The Buddha talks about different types of awakened human beings, and some of them, I can't remember the exact Pali phrases now, but there's those that awaken and have the ability to teach others. And there's those that are awakened and simply are lacking in that ability. It doesn't mean that they're less awakened. They're just not imbued with a teaching understanding. And there are those that awaken and decide to remove themselves from the world. You know, I can always remember what that's called. Again, no less awakened, but they simply have made a choice based on their awakening. Thankfully, there's enough people that awaken and want to teach the Dhamma. As an awakening or awakened human being, all Dhamma practitioners contribute to the lessening of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking in the world. Holding in mind the right intention to abandon all clinging within the framework of the Eightfold Path develops liberation from dukkha. With mindfulness of the true meaning of Dhamma, all human beings benefit from individual Dhamma practice. That's the end of the sutta. And that is one of that last line, that all human beings benefit from us practicing the Dhamma, including while we're developing awakening. There's been many, many tests done, just I'm talking about meditation in general now, on the calming effect that a group of meditators have in the extended environment. So they've done tests where they've gotten groups of meditators, 500, 1,000. I think the largest group ever gathered was 10,000, and that was TM out in Iowa, where the TM University is. I can't think of the name of it is. And the studies show that while people are meditating, whether it's and most of them were done in the heart of some or cities like Detroit or New York or Cleveland, where there's a high violence rate, while they're meditating and for a short period of time afterwards, the crime rate and the violence drops dramatically. Simply by people developing that calm and peaceful mind, there is an effect. Rupert Sheldrake called that... I can't remember it. Morphic resonance. There's an interesting story about how he came across that, but I won't give that tonight.
When they meditated, they did it like in a big public way, or they were just meditating in centers secluded, or you know, they were showing that they're meditating, or were they?
Well, a lot of the time it was done on purpose to show what happens when a group of meditators actually meditate.
They actually did the meditation in view. Like in groups in view of the public, so that
yes.
People would stop and wonder what they're doing.
Well, no, I don't know that it was a public show, but it was a controlled experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And over, this isn't just once. They've done this test in many different ways and different applications. It was first inspired by the Transcendental Meditation movement. The reason why. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who started Transcendental Meditation, really was an incredible man. I'm cautious on saying, let's just say what developed over the years is not exactly what he intended, because this is a public venue. I first started with Transcendental Meditation. It was my first introduction to meditation. The reason why he left the cave, where he was perfectly content, was that he also realized that the world was on the verge of annihilating itself. There was so much violence, and the nuclear threat was just emerging, and he heard of that. And he decided that he needed to do whatever he could to try and not get us blow ourselves off the face of the planet. And he believed that if enough people meditated, it would calm the world enough that we wouldn't do that. And there's no way of proving it, but I really think he's had that effect, because we've come very close over and over again of blowing ourselves off the planet. And that effect, by the way, is called the Maharishi effect, and it's a proven effect. So getting back to today's talk in the Chabalata Sutta, simply by us engaging in a true Dhamma practice wholeheartedly, we're having the effect, and we can leave out the Maharishi effect or morphic resonance, because that is a little bit conceptual and hard to put your finger on. I think every one of us has known the direct effect we've had on the people that are closest to you. And then even beyond that, the people that we come in contact with just as part of our mundane lives, we're more pleasant. We're more pleasant and we're more present with people. We're less reactive. And that has an effect on the world. It has to. And that gets to that great power meter of generosity. When we are fully awakened human beings, the Buddha's life is a good example of this, there is no possibility of contributing to the suffering of others. Why? Because there's no possibility of us contributing to our own suffering. I think I said this on retreat. If we really want to have peace in the world, we have to develop it within ourselves. And then when we do, we can have that effect. This is really what this whole sutta is about. By developing the right intention to recognize and abandon all craving and clinging, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and then following through on that, through right meditation and developing the entire Eightfold Path, we have that effect that we'd like to have. Everybody, and I don't care how deranged you are, everybody wants what they view as peace in the world. Some people are so psychotic that their view creates a lot of suffering in trying to achieve that. But that's the underlying motivation for everyone. We all want that. Those of us that luckily or happily are not psychotic, we want that. But most of us don't know how to go about it. And that can lead to a lot of frustration in our lives, can't it? We can't develop that peace in ourselves. We can't find a way to encourage it in others simply because we're lacking understanding. That inner desire to help everyone is part of that bodhisattva ideal. But without the Eightfold Path, most of us are too conditioned to develop the wisdom to go along with that. That's the real end of the talk today. So thank you for listening. Stefan, any questions or comments or anything at all related to the Dhamma?
I've been enjoying my home sitting practice the last week or so. I've been thinking more about my own intentions and asking myself more, trying to be clearer about what I'm really intending to do with my days, consciously and unconsciously. If really my intention is to develop the Dhamma, or if my intentions are more accurately just to like get specific bits of work done and then you know try to chill out. So I've been trying to be more honest about that, and you know, trying to set intention at the beginning of the day, you know, to say to myself what I want to do today is not create suffering for myself or other people, and you know, sort of rehearse to myself what I think is involved in that. So I don't know, I think that's been helpful.
Oh yeah, I mean, right intention really is the defining direction in Dhamma practice. We don't have it. You really can't develop the Dhamma because you don't have that focus. The intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, the intention to recognize all views that are rooted in ignorance and Four Noble Truths guides our practice. And then to make the conscious and realistic decision, what you just described, what is my intention? And there's no such thing in a general sense in a human life as a wrong intention. In other words, if your intention is that, you know, I'm just going to deal with my days and not really concern with myself with the rest of it, every human being has the right to make that decision. The reason why I'm emphasizing that is it is important to recognize that engaging in the Dhamma is, or at some point should be, a definite decision. This is what I'm going to do. That truly defines, I know you've heard the term, that truly defines a stream enterer. There's a lot of misapplication of what that really means. But once you've decided to wholeheartedly engage in the Eightfold Path, you are now a stream enterer, And crossing, the metaphor is crossing the stream of samsara, gaining awakening in that way, is assured as long as you remain within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Thank you for sharing it. It's important. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Yeah. I like in that sutta how it how there's the four different groups, the four different ways that people look at the Dhamma. They might choose to ignore it.
Yeah.
And maybe they're just unfortunate enough in their lives never to have heard of it.
Yeah.
Which is, in the U.S., I think, mostly everybody. You know, it seems like, because they're on different kinds of paths and they don't get to hear about it.
That's true.
One thing that it makes me think of is, you know, when we were on the retreat, I felt, yeah, I really didn't tell anybody what I was doing because it requires a lot of explanation and a lot of stuff, you know, that I'm not sure if I want to get into, you know, it would be too deep. But then when I came back, I saw people on, say, Wednesday, and there were three women I was working with, and we were just the three of us. The three of them asking me, well, what did you do? You were away. Oh, my goodness, how was it? What was going on? And what did? And I said, I just had a very relaxing weekend. Well, what did you do? You know, and I just said, I went on a meditation retreat. And they were fascinated and interested, and you could tell and they all said, I wish I could do that. So I thought, this is great, you know. So I said, you can, you know, you can go on a retreat. You can come to my meditation class with me sometime if you want. In any way you want, that's fine. And I told them I go to Frenchtown and I meditate. And they were fascinated and interested. You could tell they brightened up about it, you know, because it touched something in them where they were, you know, seeking. And then I did say, and it's part of Buddhism too, which is, you know, it's a deeper meaning to it, but you can start out just meditating and then you can proceed, you can go along.
Wow.
So it changed me. I thought, well, I'm just going to have to talk about it. So that's what that was.
Wow.
And I'm glad I did. And my practice has been going well, meditating regularly. After I meditate now, I do the best I can just to focus on my breathing. But afterward, I go through this kind of a ritual where I actually go and talk to myself about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path step by step, twice a day now, so that I can know how it's fitting together.
Thank you for sharing it, Kevin. That is the right application of meditation and then incorporating the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. It's the right way. It's another aspect of right action, and what you were talking about before is right speech, is presenting something in a way that will be useful. You know, you could have, you know, got up on the table and proselytize, and they would have turned them off. They never would have wanted to hear another word about meditation or Buddhism. And the skillful way that you handled it, you allowed them to, if they are interested, to come into it in a gentle way. And that's the way to do it. And again, nobody has to do it. You know? But that's great. I'm glad. Thank you. Tom, good to see you. How have you been?
Good to see you.
Good.
My meditation's been going pretty well. You know, I'm consistent with it for a while now. You know, sometimes it's more, I'm more concentrated than others, but you know, it's a habit at this point, so I'm happy with that. And but you know, it's tough sometimes, you know, following the Eightfold Path, you know, and I've been trying to learn it and understand it and been more mindful of it, so as I walk through, you know, my day, I'm, you know, it is more in my mind. But I appreciate coming here, and I haven't been here in a couple of weeks because I was on vacation, and then go to retreat. And you know, I would say that this particular sutta was interesting because I find myself wanting to talk about, you know, what I learned and my meditation. And, I tend to be very wordy at times, and I tend to, every time I hear myself talking to someone about it, I'm thinking, it's just, I need to say less, and, you know, lead by example, because it just doesn't come off right. And I don't want to do that to people. I don't want to be one of those people who are kind of preaching to other people, and you've talked about it. So I've struggled with that a little bit, you know, because I wanted to talk about it. So that's what's great about coming here. I get to talk about it, and we get to understand it. And I get to, you know, every time someone else talks, I learn a little bit more. And so it's been a good thing. But yeah, it's I'm glad to be back here today. So I'll leave it at that.
I'm glad you're back too. It's good to see you. It is I never talk about what I do or what I teach, what I write about, unless someone asks. And even then, it's usually, I'll say something like, well, I teach meditation and mindfulness within a broader framework. And then if there seems to be still interest, then I'll say, well, that broader framework is such and such. But then I don't get too deep into it, because I know that it really is something that you have to experience mostly. You know, and all the explanations I could give are likely going to create confusion then at that point. So I keep it simple and encourage people to come here and try it out. Some people do, some people don't. You know. And some people come here and try it out and they never come back. You know, some people try it and don't come back for a while, and then they seem to come back wholeheartedly. If everybody that came through here and seemed interested and continued coming, we would need a much bigger building. You know, it's very difficult to follow through on that initial interest, because there's so much distraction in the world. People just don't think you have the time, even if it's once a month, to come and join us. You know, and as you can see on a retreat, when you can be in that environment, even if it's just once or twice a year, it's almost like it's like the Dhamma on steroids. You really gain a deep understanding of it. The more you're part of it, you are part of the Sangha. But, thank you all for talking about it. Any other questions or comments? The next retreat is October 19th to the 22nd, I think, whatever that Sunday is. I'll have the registration up probably early next week, and I'll have the talks up from this past retreat up in a few days too. Really great talks, and what's really great about it are the discussions we had. Let's finish with the Buddha's words on meditation. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body, and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and that's an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.